A lifetime of training, practice, study, hard work. Through discipline, some achieve excellence, mastery, fulfillment, self-actualization. What can we learn from their beginnings, discoveries, motivations, and falls? How do they dust themselves off and resume their journey? During these interviews, stories, and conversations, we reveal their intrinsic drive.
My story, little baby born, cute little thing, tiny little nose, little ears, mother said he's gotta make it on his own, she's gotta let him go, oh no, put him in the system, he's always gonna wonder if his mother ever missed him, we move ahead and hope that life is gonna bless the little boy, we hope so. Hey, hey, strange how he never really feels like he's at home. He's running like a lone wolf, even though he's only 5 years old. Ooh, yeah, he read a little book. Now he's always gonna know that he was chosen.
At 5 years old, Rock Wilk realized he could sing. That same year, his grandfather gave him a guitar. A self-taught musician, he spent hours alone in his room playing alongside jazz greats, honing his craft. While a defensive back at Colorado State University, his creative writing teacher, Bill Tremblay, identified his immense talent, telling his reluctant student he was a playwright. Rock left college, deciding to pursue his music career. He enjoyed success in the music business, something just didn't feel right with the pop music direction he was advised to follow. Rock tells us of his lowest moment, losing his marriage, adopted mother, and financial ruin all at once. He takes us to his incredible pivot after reading at his first poetry slam at the Nuyorican Poetry Club, harnessing the power of his ability to focus from his early years as an athlete and musician. Rock found a poetry club to perform in every night and wrote constantly for 6 years, releasing Broke Wide Open, his independently produced album in 2007, which became his first solo play, enjoying a highly acclaimed run at New York City's New Theater. In 2014, Rock appeared in his first feature film, Jamesy Boy, starring James Woods, Mary Louise Parker, and Ving Rhames. Rock is the recipient of the 2016 Brio Award for Acting, presented by the Bronx Council on the Arts. This activist against social injustice, gun violence, and racism created the Brooklyn Quartet in collaboration with Greggy Gaines. His current film, The Center of Distance, featuring a breathtaking soundtrack by Steve Peckman, won Best Indie Feature Film at the 2022 Milan Gold Awards. A movie shot entirely on his phone during the pandemic. It's my pleasure to welcome Rock to this episode of Intrinsic Drive.
You really should know your father's mother didn't accept you. It's different when two people have their own. Especially in your own way, you're different than the others. I swear on a stack of Bibles that I love you. Just like family, closer than my cousins. Almost like my blood, this is what it is. I'm not sure who you are, I really don't know where you came from. I'll treat you like my own. Say it again, treat you like my own. Yeah, I treat you like my own. Hi, treat you like my own. I'll treat you like my own.
Hey, Rock, man, thanks so much for coming to Intrinsic Drive. It's so wonderful to see you and to be together, even though it's only virtually for the moment, but I hope we can remedy that soon. So thanks for coming.
Yeah, will that ever happen again, where it's just normal
right.
to hang out?
Right. I know. Let's go to the beginning for you, Rock. What was the beginning of your journey? Was there an inciting moment for you on that?
Which journey?
Yeah, like let's say the beginning for you in terms of your music.
Oh, okay. I think the beginning of my journey was when I was a little kid. I was on a bus going to school, and I used to love to sing. Except that I was like a little athlete. I was a jock, you know, like every little boy in America. I just wanted to play ball.
Yeah.
But I knew I could sing. And I remember I was on this bus going to school, and I was singing Silent Night to myself. And I remember my face was against the window, and so the sound was reverberating off, and I was singing really quiet so nobody else could hear me. And I was like, damn, I can sing. Like, I was like five.
Wow, five.
And my grandmother had given me a guitar.
Okay.
When I was 5 years old. So all around the same time, I just started to play with it. But I was embarrassed to let anybody else know. So I used to hide it under my bed.
Yeah.
But I started to, that's when I realized like, oh, wow. And also music affected me so deeply, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I would listen to music and it would make me cry. Wow. And I didn't even know why. It wasn't sad. Yeah. It just did something to me. So that's how it started. That was the beginning of the curse. That, you're an artist.
At 5 years old. And what about your athletics at this point? Like, were you playing, was it a certain sports that you were gravitating? Was it football pretty early on? Or what were you gravitating towards in terms of?
Yeah. I started playing football first, I think. But I was a runner, really. Like, I was a sprinter.
Early on.
Yeah. Like, I just wanted to race everybody.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think I lost the race from when I was, like, 5 to 12.
I believe that.
No, nobody could beat me when I was that age. Like, when I first lost, I was broken. I was devastated. You know? But I just love to run. You know, I just love to run. And, but, yeah, I was playing football, basketball, and baseball.
Okay.
My father dropped me off in a park and said, this is where you're going to play. And I met these coaches, and I started playing baseball, football, and basketball with the same coaches for years.
Wow.
You know, organized. And it was really great because it was a lot of really good athletes, you know. I mean, if you could be a good athlete when you're 5, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, but I think you can, you know. And I never played in a little league where they were hitting it off a tee. Like, I was wearing metal spikes when I was a little kid. Like, we played baseball, you know?
Okay, right.
Hardball.
Yeah.
Same thing, you know, football, everything was real, you know? I remember my coach's mother, when I was a little kid, made our uniforms because nobody could afford uniforms. So they made us these uniforms that looked like Notre Dame. Wow. You know, it was a team called the Pony Express, and we were good. Like, we had a lot of great players on that team. You know, again, we were like little kids, but I never played school ball until I went to high school. Like, I played in that sandlot stuff.
Okay.
Until I was in 10th grade.
Wow. Okay.
It's because it was better competition. It was better.
Interesting.
Like, I remember when I was in junior high school, we wound up playing the junior high school team in football, and we destroyed them. Like, embarrass them, because we were just raised differently, you know, athletically, you know what I mean? Like, we weren't treated like, well, I'm sure they treated us appropriately, but I felt like we weren't treated like little kids. Like, they really taught us how to play ball, you know, how to compete.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, and I just loved it so much, you know, and I was such a loner.
Uh-huh.
I think if I didn't play team sports, I would have had no friends, you know, because I wasn't socially comfortable in any kind of way. So sports and, you know, music and being an artist can push you even further in that direction.
That's right.
So I know even, you know, throughout till I finished high school and even into college, I probably started to change when I went to college, but I don't think I would have had any friends if I didn't play sports.
Wow. That really brought you out into, you know,
well, I just
training,
you know, I was on a team.
Yeah.
So these were my friends, you know,
yeah.
But I didn't really hang out. I just hanging out for me was going to practice.
Right. But
after that, I just went home, did push-ups, and that was my life.
And then what instruments were you playing early on? Was it guitar first? Was it keyboards?
Just guitar at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. I learned my grandmother had bought a guitar from my uncle, her son, and he never played it. So she just gave it to me. So I learned how to play. I taught myself, you know, I took all these records and I just learned how to play songs from listening to them.
Wow.
And I didn't really touch another instrument until I got out of college.
Okay. Okay.
When I started, you know, having bands and stuff like that. And I realized I needed to learn more, learn theory, learn how to play some other instruments.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I had good ears, so I learned pretty fast.
Okay. Okay. And that's sort of taking us to the ascent, and you're feeling yourself rising in your craft. Are you playing at this point now, let's say out of college, you're starting to play with bands, and how old were you then? And was there an event that made the path clear to you that you realized, oh, wow, I'm a musician?
Well, I knew I was a musician
early
in high school. In high school, it got really serious.
Okay. Okay.
Now, really only one person knew, and that was my best friend, this guy, Gene Giles, who passed away. May you rest in peace. But he was my best friend, you know, and we used to like sneak into Lincoln Center and the Village Vanguard together when we were in 10th grade, 11th grade. He was my jazz friend, you know, and he actually encouraged me. He's like, forget all this sports stuff, man. You're an artist. Like, you know, go be Wes Montgomery, you know, go be John Coltrane.
Right.
Keith Jarrett. We love Keith Jarrett. Like Keith Jarrett was my musical god, you know. And actually, the first time I heard the Cologne Concerts, you know, probably his most well-known album, that changed my life.
Wow.
Like, I remember I was in my room and my father came into the room and I had headphones on. He's like, what are you doing? I said, I'm listening to music. And he goes, well, who is it? I said, you never heard of him, but I just want to say that I never want to feel any different for the rest of my life than I feel right now.
Wow.
Like it permeated my whole soul, you know?
Yeah.
And so I knew in high school that this was who I was, you know what I mean? But I was so attached to sports.
Mm.
And, you know, I think because, you know, I was a boy in this country, a pretty good athlete.
Yeah.
You know, all I wanted was to go play in the NFL, you know, even though I was 5'9", 160 pounds. But I didn't look at that as a negative thing, you know?
Right.
It's all I wanted. So, that was a big turning point for me is Keith Jarrett and my friend Gene. And also there was a guy named Richie Hart. At the time, his name was Richie Hohenberger, and he was like a George Benson protege. But
wow, yeah,
the jazz George Benson, like before he started being a pop artist, which, you know, he's still an incredible pop artist. But Richie studied with him, was friends with him, and he was also like a you know, direct descendant of Wes Montgomery. He was like the most gifted jazz guitarist I'd ever seen. And I saw him do a concert at Rockland Community College. And I was like, well, I had never seen anything like that before in person. Like he just blew my mind. He was a freak, you know, and a freak with soul, you know, with vibe. Like it wasn't just like a machine. He just had so much spirit to what he played. And so I knew I wanted to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I started putting money aside to save up to buy that guitar that he was playing.
Wow. Okay.
And it took me 2 summers, put money aside every month.
Yep.
And I bought that guitar. And so then I quit school. I pretty much flunked out of college. You know, I went there, I played ball pretty miserably.
In Fort Collins, in Colorado.
Yeah, Fort Collins, yeah. Colorado State.
Yeah.
I just basically beat up my body for a couple of years, you know.
Yeah.
And, but then I had another really important moment. I had a teacher. Now, I was the worst student in the history of the world. Nobody's ever been a worse student than me. But I was really smart, you know, like I could memorize things. So, you know, when I was in high school, I would just memorize enough to get an 85, you know.
Got it. Yeah.
But then when I went to college, I was ill prepared. Like I had no idea how to study.
Right.
You know,
you didn't have those strategies.
So, yeah, I flunked a lot. But I had this teacher. His name was Mr. Tremblay. He was a creative writing teacher. And actually, the football coaches at that time, they made my schedule. Like, I was not taking creative writing.
Right.
You know,
right.
I literally had a class called basket weaving.
You had the basket weaving class.
Yes. So I had jock classes, sociology.
Yeah.
Principles of basketball.
Yeah. First aid.
So, and, you know, and I failed, you know, so. But I had this creative writing teacher, and it was my second semester, and he met with me after class one day, and he goes, look, I see that you didn't do too well your first semester, so I'm going to make you a deal. He goes, if you just show up to every class, I'll give you a C. Just show up. He goes, and if you hand me something that you write every class, I'll give you an A. No matter what, no tests, no nothing. Just hand me something every class. It could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, anything? Anything. So I was like, you got a deal. So I showed up to the next class, and he goes, okay, what do you got? I give him a sheet of paper. I had like torn it out of a loose leaf notebook, you know. And it was one word. Can I curse on this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. It was one word. I wrote... He was like, okay, is that it? That's what you were feeling like? That's it? I said, that's it. He goes, okay. And I was like, wow, okay. You know, because I was kind of a whole kid, you know?
Right.
So anyway, I kept doing stuff like that, but then I actually started writing. So the end of the semester comes, I fulfilled all my obligations, he gave me an A, and he met with me at the end of the semester, and he goes, listen. And, you know, he was a great guy. He was from Boston, and he's pretty well known. His name is Bill Tremblay. He's a pretty well known poet. He's kind of a revolutionary. His work is astounding, like amazing.
Wow, I want to go back.
And so anyway, he said to me at the end of the semester, he goes, listen, you know, when you get finished, you know, beating the crap out of yourself on the football field, I just want to let you know, you're a playwright.
Wow. He said that to you.
And I was like, a playwright? I'm like, yo, I'm a defensive back. He goes, you're a playwright. He goes, so just saying.
Wow.
So fast forward 35 years late. Oh, and he said to me, you want to take all the stuff you wrote? I said, no, you could keep it. So I didn't even take it. But 35 years later, I was opening a play off Broadway, my first play.
Yeah.
Broadway. And I remembered, he's literally the only teacher I remember in my life.
Oh my gosh, Rob.
And I looked for him on the internet, and I found him on Facebook. And I wrote to him. I said, you probably don't remember me, blah, blah, blah. And I sent him my script. And he wrote me back the most beautiful email. He remembered everything about me. He remembered what I was wearing when I walked into class the first time.
What a beautiful.
He remembered that I had concussions and I had mono that semester, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, you told me I was a playwright. So that was a big thing. He was very encouraging. And I'm in contact with him now.
I mean, that's
and, you know, every once in a while I'll be doing a show and he buys two tickets. He was living in Fort Collins still.
Really?
And he would buy two tickets to these shows just to, you know, for him and his wife. And obviously they couldn't come. They were 2,000 miles away.
Right.
And he would say, just give them to somebody who can't afford them.
Wow.
So I would just find two kids and give those tickets to somebody else. And been incredibly supportive and encouraging, and he's amazing. So I think those were the things that really, you know, and then when I realized like football just hurt my body and my soul and my spirit, I was done, you know, I was finished. I started to grow out of this obsession that we have as athletes in this country, you know, like we just want to be.
Right.
Everybody thinks they could be a professional athlete, and, you know, maybe everybody can, but not everybody winds up, you know, there's a lot more than just being good, as you know. You know, there's a lot more than just being talented. There's a million athletes in this country who are talented enough to be in the NBA or be in the NFL or maybe not run in the Olympics, but be professional baseball player. There's a ton, but a lot of circumstances and also an incredible amount of commitment and support of your family and your friends, you know, stuff like that. There's a lot that goes behind it, you know? So when I was obsessed, you know, like football was my life, you know? even though, you know, I don't even like football anymore. Like, you know, I've changed so much spiritually. I mean, I boycott the NFL because of Colin Kaepernick anyway. You know?
Yeah. I remember the other day.
I find it to be
we were connecting. Yeah. And you said, I'm not even going to watch the Super Bowl. You said on one of your videos, even.
Yeah.
You said, look, I'm working. I'm
just, yeah.
I'm working a piece right now, you know?
Exactly. I really don't have much interest.
Right.
But, you know, when I got it out of my system, that's when I decided, you know, I quit school. I remember I told my father, you know, I'm quitting school. Because when I came home, I tried to finish school at Fordham in the Bronx. I mean, at Lincoln Center.
Okay.
And I did. In real life, I had an anxiety dream where I didn't go to class the whole semester. And then I showed up for the final, and I literally did not know where the classroom was.
Yeah, I've had a lot of those.
And so I was like, wow, this is like a dream that people have. You know, yeah. Like I'm walking around.
Very common, yeah.
And then so what I did is I left. I went downtown. I went to my father's office, and I said, I'm quitting school. He goes, what are you talking about? Your finals are now. I said, I'm quitting today. He goes, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to sing. He goes, you're going to sing? Good luck with that. And that was it. I never turned back. Like I was done. You know, I just committed myself to music at that time. And, you know, that was, you know, a good place for that moment in my life, but not, I still wasn't in the right place.
Okay. And then brings us to the discovery rock, kind of your learning to these experiences and events and, you know, what new things came to light? Who were some other mentors besides Bill at CSU? And because he wasn't really a mentor yet.
No.
Even though you knew, you know, later on it comes into light. But some of the other coaches, teachers, what was revealed?
Well, I really had one mentor, I think. When I was young, like before I was 18, I had one mentor, and it was a guy named Jimmy Pinkston. He was a great athlete. He played football at the University of Miami. He was much older than, you know, probably, I don't know, like probably 8 years older than me or something like that. Maybe, yeah, probably around 8 years older than me. And, but, you know, when you're 12, that's a big difference, you know?
Absolutely.
All he did was work out. 24, like this guy just trained all the time. He was the most serious guy I'd ever known. And so I used to go down to this park in Spring Valley called Memorial Park. And I would train with him, and he kind of took me under his wing. And he taught me how to, he was my Kobe. You know, he taught me how to train. He taught me how to be serious about it. He taught me how to show up, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
He taught me, because he had no tolerance. Like if you didn't show up, if you didn't, you know, if you weren't serious, he would just, you know, I mean, he wouldn't tell you to leave, but he would just not pay attention to you. But, and he also, you know, I took that, you know how, I think it's kind of a stupid cliche sometimes when coaches go, you know, playing football gives you lessons for life. Like, I don't really believe that, but he did give me lessons for life because I was really committed to that. It, you know, nobody, people used to come to the park and try to hang with us. Nobody could hang with us. Nobody. You know, people would come down. It was legendary. And people tried, but they couldn't. And he was a real mentor for me. But then a couple of years later, when I went into music, there was a guy named Phil Clendenin, who I was in his band. I joined his band. And he introduced me to MIDI, you know, like electronic music.
Yes, yes.
And this guy, Phil, is a genius. Genius. Like, he could talk to you about nuclear physics and the Yankees in the same elevated way. Like he's a true genius, you know. He taught me how to approach, you know, producing music. Like, you know, he was so encouraging and so supportive. Like he thought I was a genius, you know, and I was like, what are you talking about? He was so encouraging that I started to believe him, you know, but he taught me with incredible patience how to get the music from here and here into a form where I could share it, you know, to record digital, you know, he taught me digital audio. He taught me MIDI. He taught me everything.
Wow.
All the digital audio programs. He taught me how to use a computer.
And how to edit, which you became.
How to do everything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like he made me take my computer apart and put it back together when I first got it. because he was like, you have to lose the fear. It's only a tool.
Right, right.
No. He taught, and he was taking phone calls from me at like 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, how do you do this? What's up? You know, how come this is, I got latency with this connection, you know? And he was so patient and he helped me with my albums. You know, I was putting projects together and he was just like, I learned so much from that guy. He was so generous and probably the most incredibly gifted jazz pianist I've ever been around in person, or at least one of them. You know, I've known so many, but he's just, you know, a genius person and a musician. And so he was a real mentor for me up until that point. And then I had a lot of people that helped me a lot in the music business, but I knew pretty quickly, you know, I started as a jazz player and then I wound up being managed by a guy named Dick Scott, who's, you know, like the most powerful man in the music business for a while. And he tried to turn me into a pop star, you know, and, you know, I was into it, you know, but I remember I went to a club on 72nd Street called Trax, and Prince was performing there.
Whoa. Okay.
With the Time.
No.
So
way.
Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and all those guys were there. Sheila E.
Oh, wow. Sheila.
And so I remember I went to see that show. This happened twice to me. This was the first time. I saw Prince. And I remember I was sitting next to this girl, Debbie, who was my girlfriend at the time. And she's like, why are you so quiet? Like the club is going crazy. You know, like they just turned that place out.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, if I can't do that,
right?
I don't want to be in this business. Like if I can't be that, like that level of playing and performing and connecting and writing and everything, like it just made me feel like I suck. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, if I can't do that, I have no business being here.
Nothing compares to you, right?
Yeah.
Prince.
I mean, he made my head explode. Yeah. So actually, I think that made me a lot better as a musician.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then I also saw a band one night, a local band. I used to play at this club called JP's on the East Side. And it was a band playing called the Mark McMillan Band. And I mean, these guys were like a cross between Steely Dan and what's his name? I can't remember who I'm thinking. Oh, Bobby Caldwell.
Okay.
And they blew me away. Like they were incredible, you know, their level of musicianship and the tightness of the band. And, you know, so I had a really good band, you know? But I kind of felt like, you know, I don't know if, like, I'm not reaching. I personally didn't feel like, other people disagreed with me, but I didn't feel like I could do that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't see myself getting to that level that I'm looking at. And so, you know, but then years went by and I started playing with better, you know, putting myself around better musicians and getting better myself and playing. And, you know, I played in every club in New York City, you know, and then I started doing studio work and did some touring and stuff like that. But less and less was I loving what I was doing. You know, it didn't, none of this felt like Keith Jarrett to me.
Okay.
None of it. None of it felt like Coltrane or Miles. This just felt like we're trying to get a record deal. And, I felt like
outcome. It was outcome driven.
Yes. I'm like, I'm not going to be Michael Jackson or Prince or, you know, Elton John. I mean, I didn't see myself that way.
Right.
You know,
right.
I actually felt like the musicians in my band were much better musicians than I was, you know, overall, not just playing, but, you know, maybe I was strongest as a writer, but, or maybe an arranger or producer or whatever, you know, I think I was a good producer, you know, but, and, you know, I had so many great musicians in my band. You know, my band was over 100 people, whoever happened to be in town.
Whoa.
That's why I had to learn charts and learn how to play some instruments, because whoever was in town was my band for that gig. So I had different bands all the time, but I was so incredibly fortunate to play with some of the most incredible musicians in the world, like legendary musicians. who were playing in my band, you know, but I didn't feel like I was up to that level personally. I think they might've thought I was, but I didn't, you know? And, but the main thing for me was it just wasn't feeding me. I didn't feel the same way that I felt when I was a kid, or like, even, you know, even when I was in college, I went to a talent show one night at this place called the Towers Tap. Anybody who knows Colorado State University knows the Towers Tap probably, and because I'm sure it's still there. And I saw a talent show and I was like, I could do that. And they were winning money. So I started showing up at these talent shows and I was like a hustler. I was making money. I learned, wow. I love this. Kenny Loggins had a live album. Loggins and Messina had a live album, and Kenny Loggins on one part of the album did like four or five songs, just solo guitar. And it was like a really soulful kind of beautiful rendition of these songs. And so I learned those songs and I just played them at these talent shows and I was making bank, like I was making money. and it felt good, you know, yeah. But then yeah. The music business took me in a whole different direction. So perhaps if I stayed as just a singer, songwriter, guitar player, you know, more in that kind of realm, it might have fed me spiritually more and I might have stayed, you know, but I went into this more, you know, bigger, you know, George Michael, let's be, you know, Genesis kind of band. Sting, you know, like it just took me somewhere where I felt like it didn't feel right. You know what I mean? Like
it was away from the art. It was a disconnection.
Well, it was a part of the art that I wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's a great artistry, you know, like look at Queen, you know,
or yeah. Oh, yeah.
People like that, like, or Prince, you know, Michael Jackson. I mean, these are incredibly gifted artists.
I wasn't over into pop. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't that, you know, and that's where people were trying to put me, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't know. I think maybe I had the ability to do it, but there was something making me reticent to go all the way in.
That makes sense.
And so, I don't know. I didn't enjoy it, you know?
Yeah. And then what was driving you forward at the time? Was there anything you were noticing externally and internally, like forces or motivations during that time in your life?
Or just probably
knowing what you didn't want to go into. Was that more...
I think what was driving me forward was I never give up.
Of course, yeah.
My ego probably, you know, like I'm in so deep, I gotta win now, you know. Like it was probably my ego and just the fact that I don't like to give up, you know. And you know, and then I would look at certain artists and I'd be like, I could do that, or I could do that. Like that could be, you know, like mm-hmm. there were plenty of examples that I did feel like I could be on that level. But there was something in me that knew this is not the last stop.
Right.
I don't know when it's going to happen. And perhaps if I got a major deal at that time, because I had a couple of deals that were not good deals, you know, and were really kind of sucked the life out of you business-wise, you know. Perhaps if they worked out, I would have stayed. And I don't think that I would have enjoyed that as much. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it would have been as fulfilling for me because there was another place for me to go, you know?
Yeah. And this poetry never maybe would have come out of that, that ripping out of your chest if you hadn't had that moment where you realize, you know, something's not right in this direction. You know, it wasn't pulling you into that full joy. You weren't able to be fully present into it and put your heart and soul into it.
I knew one big part of it for me was, you know, I'm an activist, right? So
absolutely.
Early on, I wrote a lot of songs about racism and white privilege, and
yeah.
And every time I send that to a record company, they were like, "Yeah, ain't nobody want to hear that." Like,
right?
You know, no. You know, the industry did not really support that kind of work at that time. You know, and I wasn't being allowed to be who I was, and so it kind of bored me after a while, you know, like I love the music, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I did really enjoy my bands. You know, I think of some of the people that I work with, you know, I'm not going to mention their names because nobody would know who they are, but you know, local musicians in New York who are amazing musicians, you know, who have worked with, you know, the top musicians in the world, the side people.
Yeah.
And we had so much fun. I had a regular gig at Bitter End. I used to play at Mikkel's and 7th Avenue South and all these legendary clubs.
Yeah.
And we did. We had so much fun, you know, but it didn't feel like it was going to be a profession for me forever. You know, I was living like a 17, you know, I was living in poverty, you know. And then when I started to make better money, it was boring to me, you know, like it wasn't enough money to be like, okay, I'll do this and buy 12 houses and 16 cars and,
right,
you know, give money to take every homeless person off the street and end racism, you know, like,
right.
I wasn't making that kind of money. So, yeah, it was chaos in my soul at that time. But not to say that I wasn't enjoying parts of it, you know, I had some great experiences. I got to travel a lot, you know, I got to go all over the country, I spent months in Europe at one time because I was part of an international music festival. And yeah, I got to work with some incredible people, but it was nothing for me at the end of the day. You know, it was like, meh. Not that I didn't appreciate it, but it wasn't my soul. I wasn't happy. You know, I was a happy person, I guess, by nature in many ways, even though I know a lot of people think I'm the angriest person in the world. But, you know, I was happy with what I had. I appreciated everything. I was grateful. But I wasn't, you know, I was like, eh.
Yeah.
You know, many people would say I didn't have enough gratitude, or, you know, I was taking things for granted. But I look at it more like I was in the wrong place. You know, I was displaced, you know, which is kind of the story of my life, you know, how my life started. So
that's right.
That's how I felt. I felt like I don't belong here. You know, like saying, you know, I'm not really a part of this, you know, kind of on the outskirts, you know.
Right. On the outside. And
my whole life has been kind of like that.
Absolutely. No, it's part of being adopted from that beginning, right? And what about the fall, Rock, speed bumps along the way? Tell us about the lowest moment in your career or life overall. Was there an inciting moment for this low moment or event?
Oh, yeah. That's easy for me.
Yeah.
The lowest moment was when my marriage split up.
Yeah.
And my mother died. And all this stuff happened at the same time. And along with that came financial death, you know, like really bad. And I was in darkness, you know, because first of all, I never thought my marriage would end, you know, and we're still very, very close today, you know,
yes.
But I never thought that would happen, you know. So that's something that I'll never feel good about, you know. And my when my mother passed, like she was the last remnants of this, my adoptive family. Like my father was gone, my grandmother, like everybody was gone. I have no relationship with any cousins or uncles or aunts or anybody. Like I have no family, you know, none. And so when my mother passed, it was like the last remnants of these people who I always considered saved my life, you know, because I was... Yeah. In three foster homes before they adopted me. So I was like, and then all this other stuff happened. And plus, you know, 9/11 had just recently happened. And I was like, wow, you know, like I'm kind of like that foster kid again, you know, like I felt out there, you know, like I felt unattached to anything, you know, detached, broken from everything, you know. And, it was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me because I was like, you know what? I called a friend of mine who I was working with in the music business at the time. And I was like, don't ever call me for another gig. I'm out. I said, what are you talking about? You're out. I said, I'm out. Don't call me anymore. I'm done. And I started writing because, you know, years earlier, I saw Whoopi Goldberg do her solo show and I saw it at Radio City, actually.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't at Radio City. It was in one of the Broadway theaters. But anyway, I saw that show and I remember thinking, oh, wow, that's what I want to do. Like, that is me right there.
Wow. Okay.
She was on stage by herself, solo theater, talking about, you know, gentrification and homeless people and racism and sexism and homophobia and everything. And I was like, wow. And she's getting paid. And this theater is packed. You know, I was enthralled, you know, I knew, but that was years earlier, you know? So when all this stuff happened in my life, I decided that's what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to start now. And, I started writing and I started watching YouTube videos and I found, I don't even know how I found this because, I don't know. First of all, you mentioned poetry. So I had never even read a poem in my life, let alone written one at this point. Like I never heard of any poet other than maybe I heard of Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I knew nothing about poetry. I literally had never read a poem, ever. You know, unless like, you know, maybe some stupid thing that we did in first grade or something like that. But I didn't know anything about poetry.
Well, obviously, there's something because your teacher, Bill, at CSU saved
poetry in that class. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But yes, he was a great influence.
Yeah.
But I didn't know anything about his work. I was totally preoccupied with myself at that time. I wasn't paying attention to him or, you know, I was appreciating that he was being nice to me. But at the time, I was just like a jerk. You know, I was like a jock. I thought I was, you know, the shit and, you know. I don't know how I had any friends at that time. You know, I was like all about what I'm doing and that's it, you know? And I was just, all I did was work out 24 hours a day and play music. Like that was it. I did nothing else. You know, I didn't go to parties. I didn't do anything. I didn't go to one party in high school ever. Literally, like nobody ever saw me at a party. And anybody who says they did, they're lying. I never went to one party ever. So anyway, I was on YouTube one day and I saw a poet at the New Eureka Poets Cafe, which also I had never heard of. And I can't remember his name now, but I was stunned by what I saw. You know, it was like this real rhythmic. It wasn't hip hop. It was a rhythmic performance piece. You know, it was theater.
Yeah.
Beautiful. You know, I thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And I became obsessed with it. And then I started writing. And I don't know where these words were coming from, but I was writing constantly and I was so depressed. I was so fucked up at that time. And I was living in Asbury Park where I knew nobody. I didn't know one person there.
Okay. That was after suffering. That was Asbury Park.
That was after Brooklyn, you know,
after Brooklyn. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Like when we split up, I went to Asbury Park.
Okay. Okay.
And I stayed there for 3 years and I actually moved there because I wanted to go somewhere where I didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure my father was rolling over in his grave knowing that I moved to New Jersey, but that's what I did. I went to New Jersey and I loved it. I am forever an Asbury Park guy. Like I love Asbury Park so much. It was,
yeah, I remember you said
it was mystical. It was beautiful. They embraced me like their son, like the creative community in Asbury Park changed my life.
Wow.
And so I started writing and actually a friend of mine read one of these poems. He was like, yeah, Rock, I think the idea is to write your way out of depression, not deeper in. I'm like, nah, man, I'm going all the way in.
Yeah.
So I wrote Darkness, you know, and then a friend of mine who I met in Asbury, she brought me to a poetry club. She goes, you're a spoken word artist.
Yeah. I'm like, oh.
So she brought me to this place called Loser Slam. It was in Long Branch. And I got up and I performed something there and I felt something. Mm-hmm. And then the next day I went to the New Eureka because somebody said to me, yo, you hang out at the New Eureka? And I'm like, what's the New Eureka? And then I went to the New Eureka the next night. I got up on stage. I mean, I got on the list. You have to get on the list. I was so scared. And, you know, I had performed for 20 years. In music, like I wasn't afraid. I was never nervous. I was so nervous and so afraid to get on that stage. And these poets in this club were off the charts, gifted, yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I got on the list and I went up there and I don't even remember it, but I remember I got a really good response from the audience. And And I remember the host, this guy named Jai Poetic, he goes, "That's the angriest cry I ever heard on this stage." And, you know, people laugh, but, you know, he said it in fun. You know what I mean? It was supportive. You know, he was really, he was a great guy.
Yeah.
And I realized I was on that stage and I thought to myself, oh, this is why I was born.
Yeah.
Like, I literally felt that. I was like, oh, this is it.
Wow.
Like, I'm supposed to be on stage telling stories like this. And so, yeah, the lowest part of my life, that was it. That was when, and, you know, I wasn't really, I don't consider myself a poet at all. And I never even considered what I was doing poetry, because actually what I was doing was working on a play.
Yeah.
I had just finished an album.
That was Broke Wide Open. That was the genesis.
And every time somebody heard that album, they would say, "This feels like a play." I'm like, "What are you talking about? You know, it's an album." But then I realized it was kind of a play. So I started to turn it into, first it became a performance piece, which was 4 hours long and crazy. And then I met another mentor after that, who also really changed my life, a guy named Stephen Bishop Seeley. And that started my playwriting and theater artist life, where Stephen became my director and mentor and taught me how to be a theater artist, taught me about theater, taught me everything, how to write a play, how to get it up on its feet, how to workshop it, how to do everything. He read, you know, like, he would sit with me once a week. We'd sit in this coffee shop down in Asbury, and he never told me anything. He would just ask me questions. And then he would say, "So, you know, go work on that." And I'd write 100 new pages, and he would actually read it and sit with me again the next week. We did the same thing for 3 years.
Wow.
And I actually worked with him for almost 8 years. I could never repay him for what he taught me. You know, that guy taught me how to be in the theater, how to be a theater artist. He gave me I feel like I went to a conservatory. Like, I didn't know what downstage meant, or, you know, I didn't know what anything meant. You know, I didn't know anything about lights, set design, sound design, nothing. I went from that to doing an off-Broadway production with him 6 years later. It took 6 years. So that was amazing. You know, that was a big turning point for me.
And then, you know, obviously Jack Rollins, you know, and his wife, they're urging you forward, and they're big mentors. Where were they in this timeline with Stephen Bishop Seeley as well? Were they sort of all coinciding, or?
Well, they were more supportive of my music.
Okay.
I met them when I was really young. Okay. And actually my first real girlfriend was their daughter.
Oh, wow. I didn't
know. So she, Francesca, and she brought me home one night, and I met Jack Rollins. And, so I became like family. They like adopted me. You know? And I don't think they ever went to dinner for the next 20 years without me. You know, I was in their apartment all the time, taking trips to the country. And they were so encouraging and so, but you know, Jack Rollins loved me because he knew I played football, and he loved the Giants. So we became Giant. Like, I talked to him about the Giants all the time. You know, I didn't really talk to him about music, about the arts, even though he was a legendary guy. I didn't want him to ever think I wanted something from him, you know, so I never talked about it with him. And Mrs. Rollins, you know, Jane Rollins, she was very supportive. She came to all my gigs, you know. Francesca was amazing, you know. So yeah, they were very supportive. But when I shifted to theater, not so much, you know. I think a lot of people in my life, because it was so late in my life and I had spent 20, 25 years in the music business,
right,
people were like, "Oh, what are you going to be, a brain surgeon next?" Right. You know, like, people were not very supportive.
Mm.
You know? Not to say that the Rollins were not supportive, but I don't think that, I don't think people took it seriously. You know, I don't think people respected what I was doing. I think they thought I was crazy. I was having a midlife crisis or whatever. And that's why I tell people, you know, in a lot of workshops that I do, like, if you want to do something and you're really serious about doing it, and you, I don't care when you start, if there are people in your life telling you not to do it or you can't do it, lose those people fast.
That's right. That's right.
Because they will stop you. And, you know, I had a lot of people at that time in my life, you know, people who I thought were my people, my friends, whatever, who were really making it difficult for me to make this transition. And I knew that, like, I didn't touch a guitar or sing a note for 3 years while I was making this transition, because I knew I had to break from my past to learn how to do this.
You had to kill that character almost, kill the Rock Wilk musician character to let the poet and the playwright emerge, because it was such a new, it was a new work that was leading you on. You weren't, it was taking you over.
I mean, and I feel like my, whatever gifts I've been given in my life, you know, I mean, I'm not one who believes in God, but if my God-given gifts are so much more present in what I'm doing now than what I was doing before. I mean, I'm a good musician. I was a good singer, you know, but I let it go. And, you know, and I brought it back. You know, I scored a miniseries that I did. I did all the music for Broke Wide Open. Broke Wide Open was a musical. So I brought the music back eventually. And I, you know, the thing about theater for me and film now is that I'm able to use everything that I've learned, you know, everything, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but that was a really difficult transition. I lost a lot of friends.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I don't even speak to most people from before that transition in my life now, like very few. And I'm sad about that. You know, I miss a lot of those people, but I know that they, I think a lot of it also had to do with the fact that a lot of those people were artists when they were young and they had let that go and done other things. And maybe in a way they kind of felt like, I don't know, like, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but I kind of felt like you're kind of being a hater. You know what I mean? Like, just because I'm staying here doing this, because people would say things to me like, when are you going to grow up? Or, you know, when are you going to do this or that? Or when are you going to have kids? Or, and I'm like, when are you going to say something that's any of your business? You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. I also kind of understand people worry about you. And I was just starting something new, brand new that I'd never done before. And in fact, it took 6 years of, I wrote every day for 6 years when I was doing Broke Wide Open. Like, I literally wrote and I performed every single, I performed over 300 and I would say over 330 or 340 days a year for 4 years working up to Broke Wide Open, because I developed it in the streets. So I was in a poetry club every night. Like, you know, in New York, there's like a circuit. So like there was a place called Bar 13 that was Monday nights. The Bowery was Tuesday nights.
Okay.
The New Eureka was Wednesday nights. Loser Slam down in Asbury was Thursday nights. Then I'd find places like Soul Suite Sanctuary up in the Bronx on Friday nights. Books in the Hood on Saturday night. Like, I found a microphone every single day.
This was your training, like my Kenya. This was your training.
Exactly.
This was your training, man.
This is my training. Every single day I got up on a mic and I had to learn how to, like, I was memorizing. My plays are 2.5 hours long. So I was like developing my muscles all the time.
Yeah.
And
multiple characters. You're moving between multiple characters and little intense physicality. You're jumping. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, that too, you know, like, well, that's another thing I brought with me, you know, the stuff that I learned from you and you guys, you know, like
the athlete.
I'm telling you, if I didn't learn how to take care of my body properly from you and from Tommy and from Jim,
yeah,
I would not have been able to do a lot of stuff that I did, because, you know, I was training wrong, you know, and, you know, I still use the rope every morning of my life, you know, and my back is still like, if I don't take care of myself, my body just falls apart. You know, I have people who tell me, like, you know, I know that playing football was probably the worst thing that I ever did in my life, because I have so much left over from that.
Yeah. Because you had so much scar tissue in that hamstring. I mean, it was so much tissue, fascia distortion and imbalance and, you know,
the
anterior pelvic tilt from years and years and years, and, you know,
my hips,
yeah,
my psoas, everything is screwed up.
Yeah.
So I feel like I manage it, but it's never, you know, probably if I went to a doctor and had MRIs, they would definitely want to do surgery on me. You know, like I know that I have so many imbalances, but I've learned how to, you know, like my back is not going out anymore like it used to, you know, my hips don't go out. You know, I'm not done for like 6 weeks. I mean, I remember the first time I met you guys, I was down for 6 months.
I remember. Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
I was in ice baths for 6 months.
I know. Yeah.
Stretching. I remember the first time I worked with Tommy, I called him up after the first session. I was like, yo, it got worse. And he goes, that's awesome.
Yeah. I remember that too.
So he goes, we're trying to like undo you first. Like we have to untangle everything.
Yeah. Unwind all the, the old patterns.
So just get, you know, put some cold water in the tub, throw some ice in there and get in.
Yeah.
And I was like, that too?
Yeah.
But, the low point was the high point for me.
Yeah, that was
it. And, I'm in the right place. You know, I wound up in the right place.
Absolutely. And what about the rollback, Rock? Like, let's say you had the opportunity. Would you redo anything or do anything differently if you could?
I would do everything. Well, I can't say. You know what I mean? Like, we all go through difficult times. You know, we all go through challenging times. We all have experiences that we wish we could have done better. We've made choices that we wish we didn't make. You know, we wish we could have, fixed things or whatever. But that's not real life. You know, like if I would say I would go back and do this better or this differently or that, then maybe I wouldn't have, you know, had some of the experience that I've had in the theater. You know, I've had some experiences that I could never even describe to people because of my theater work. Like I've traveled so much because of theater. You know, I've been everywhere and I've met some of the most incredible people, but I'm not wealthy. That's for sure. And so I don't think I would do anything different. You know, perhaps I would be a nicer person, you know, to some people in the past. Maybe I would have reached out more to people. You know, I was really always such a solitary person, such a loner. And I think in many ways that manifested into who I am now. Like it's really difficult for me to connect still.
Yes.
Because I think I've been like, you know, molding this person my whole life. And so, but, you know, I'm not really responsible for it as a little kid. And all the things that happened to me when I was young. But so I would say I wouldn't do anything different. I wish things had been easier or maybe better for people that were affected around me. I know that a lot of people got hurt around me for some of my decisions. You know, I know that I hurt a lot of people. I wish I hurt nobody, you know. I probably could have been a better communicator with some of my decisions. But, you know, I was young. You know, I was stupid. That's what we do. I mean, we live in an era now where we don't forgive anybody for anything. And if somebody finds out you did something wrong when you were 12 years old, then you're canceled and you're finished. Like, I wish for people to be more forgiving rather than look back and think they could have done things better. Because I would say that some of the most incredible people that I know in my life are people who've done some of the most difficult things in their past. You know, I know people who've done some bad shit and who've been through some really difficult times, and they've come out of it to become some other level of spiritual human being. And who can you learn from more than somebody who's been through the darkness, you know?
Yeah, out of the extreme darkness comes the extreme light and the opportunity for redemption. For change, transition.
That's what life is to me, but it doesn't seem like that's the way the world is now. But for me, that's what it is. It's like you don't become a whole person unless you have an opportunity. I mean, not everybody gets the opportunity to fix things, you know?
That's right.
It's part of it too. So you got to be really grateful for that. But yeah, I think I hurt some people, and, but I've been hurt pretty bad too. You know, so
absolutely.
you have to learn how to recover. And I think, you know, I remember the first really big review that I got for Broke Wide Open. Somebody said that Broke Wide Open is a story of resilience. And I had never looked at it that way, but then I thought, it is, you know, yes, it's a story of just, this happened, keep going, this happened, keep going, this happened, keep going.
Yeah.
You know, just keep going, keep going. And, you know, that's sports.
Yes.
That's learning how to play an instrument. You know, like you suck, you suck, you suck, you suck, you're good.
Yeah.
It just happens.
Yeah.
Running, you know, you're tired, you have no cardiovascular fitness, you got no strength, and all of a sudden you're strong.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden it's easy, you know. You know, I never thought I could run more than a mile and a half distance. But at some point I said, you know what, I want to run 4 or 5 miles every day. I want to run 6 miles. So that's when I started studying Phil Maffetone, you know, and started running slow, you know, and started training differently.
Yeah.
And learned more about my nutrition. And all of a sudden, you know, I got to the point where it was like, wow. And that changed my biology forever, because my cardiovascular fitness completely changed, you know.
That's right.
Maybe also because I got older, but it completely changed. You know, I became a different kind of athlete, you know.
Absolutely. You started burning fat as fuel. You were transitioning from being a power sprinter to being able to do endurance. And a lot of that was also the nutritional piece. And, you know, now your regimen is wheatgrass and whole food nutrition and micro.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot different than, you know, La Familia, you know, at the
corner. Yeah.
And seeing the guys and the mofongo and, you know, stuff in the
area. I still love all of that.
Yeah. Well, cause
just not every day.
Right. You're a New Yorker. You know how to balance it. I think that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it feels like you, was there a certain event or decision on the anvil that forged you, a defining moment that shaped your destiny? I know there's so many, but is there one that stands out? I think obviously it's the poetry coming out of just bursting out of your chest, as we see in the new film, The Center of Distance.
I think if I'm being really honest, I'm still looking for that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that's happened to me yet. You know, I just finished this film. Because I still feel like there's so much more that I don't even know about. There has to be, you know. I'm still in kind of in the middle pattern. You know, I just moved. I left the city. It's a big deal for me, you know.
Big deal.
I'm living in a place where I don't know anybody.
Yeah. And you're learning new things every day. Like you say, look, you shot and filmed this all on your smartphone. It's an amazing movie. When you get a chance to this, you know, won the gold medal award at Milan, and it's, you know, best indie film. And you can see it's unbelievable. And the music is breathtaking. And so please go and see this.
Steve Peckman, the music.
Steve Peckman. Absolutely. And the soundtrack is unreal. And it just, it's a blessing. And all these things you're able to learn because of the lockdown. So you think of all this happened because of a global pandemic. You had to, there wasn't any choice. This was, you were queued up to do your play. And then all of a sudden the world shuts down. You had gigs, you said booked all the way through the whole year. And then all of a sudden a week later, when you're getting ready to do the first theater, it's done. And
yeah, I had the biggest opening of my life.
Yeah.
Scheduled and in June of 2020. And I had prepared like 2 years for that. And I think I was more prepared for that than anything ever in my life. Like, wow. I was going to blow that place up.
Yeah.
It was done, you know. And I knew for months that it was going to get canceled. But when it actually got canceled, that took me down. Like, I was like, wow. And I was scared, you know, like,
yeah.
The pandemic at that time was really bad. And and I didn't know what to do. You know, like, I don't think anybody knew what to do. You know, like, how do we live? What do we do? So, I decided to try to make a movie with my phone. And, you know, YouTube has been so good to me, I guess, because, you know, it got me into poetry and theater. And then I became obsessed with filmmaking, you know, and I started, oh, my God, you know, there is some artists that share stuff on YouTube that are, I don't, you know, like, it's school. Like, it's incredible. They're so generous spirited people and so smart and so gifted. So I started following some of these filmmakers, and then I wound up buying a camera with my pandemic money.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And some lenses, and I've become obsessed with it. You know, like I'm in love with filmmaking and the process of making a film coming from the play. I thought that I could just use my theatrical script and make a movie. But after 3 months of doing that and hating everything that I did, I realized I couldn't do that. Like, it's not the same. Filmmaking is not theater. So, and I didn't want to do a performance video. Like, I had already done that. I have a mini series called Brooklyn Quartet. And it's, I mean, it's really this guy, David Diaz, a filmmaker, helped me to do that. He did a great job. And I'm really proud of it, but it was not really what I wanted.
2019, when you released that, I think.
Yeah, it became a performance video, kind of like from a live theater.
Okay.
And a performance at Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn. And we kind of put it together and I scored it like a movie, but it wasn't a movie. I wanted to make a movie or a mini series for real. And so that to me was like, eh. I mean, I'm very proud of it and I'm glad it exists. But this, I wanted to make a movie. I wanted to be a visual story. I wanted to learn how to do that. And it took me about 3 or 4 months before I started thinking. I realized, oh my God, I'm starting to think like a filmmaker now. Like, I don't need the words.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have seen this film. It's not what they expected from me because they usually expect me to be running around and yelling and screaming and big and loud. And this, I never raised my voice in the whole film.
It was very quiet and internal, and it was so beautiful. It was such a reconciliation, you know, such a beautiful coming into a new story, a new truth.
Mm, thank you. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah.
And the music, I have to say, like Steve, you know, the reason I reached out to him is because he had seen a reading of the play.
Okay.
Like 3 or 4 times. So he knew the story.
Yeah.
And it resonated with him and his wife, Susan. And he's like a Coltrane level saxophone player. Like he's, you know, he's he's off the charts talented. And also he's a really creative spirit. Like he doesn't think in a linear way. He's all over the place.
Yeah.
He's organized, but he's very creative. And so I told him, I said, look, would you score this film? And it took him like three. He goes, yes. I was like, do you want to think about it? He goes, no. He just wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But then I told him, I said, listen, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Like, I want you to score this film. I want you to feel good about what you do. I want you to score a film. I don't want to guide you because I'm kind of a control freak.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Any director who's worked with me will tell you they hate me because I don't let anybody direct me. You know, it's like...
Right, you're in everything. Sure, yeah.
But with this, because if I don't think that you're as committed as I am, then you can't tell me shit.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to respect you, you know?
Right.
And but Steve is different, you know. He was so committed to it. And so all I said was I wanted to feel like... Cinema Paradiso, which is my favorite film.
Like five movies you mentioned or something. It wants to feel like these five, an amalgam of these five or something.
And I sent him the movies.
Yeah.
And I think that he did that. You know, he was successful.
It's a love
story. Because, you know, I said, obviously the music will be different, but it has to feel like
it's so
Roma.
Eclectic. It's so eclectic. The musicians and the artists from, you know, it's some haunting pieces and then and then the energetic.
Beautiful.
And then the instrumental and it just takes your breath.
It's so beautiful. He worked so hard.
You can
like
tell.
I'm telling you, he worked on every individual section of that story. And he knew the story and he expressed himself musically for what he used, like the sound of buses as crescendos with his music, the sound of birds. He brought in flutes to fly with the birds, you know, like he used the Bronx as part of his music. Cause this film is also like a love letter to my neighborhood, you know? I could, you know, like I'm so grateful to what he did and the songs that I got from all the other singer songwriters. I mean, I think we have the greatest soundtrack ever.
It's remarkable. And
so I'm going to put that together too. I'm going to try to make a soundtrack, but
please, please. Yeah.
It's so amazing.
And some of them you didn't know, you reached out to mutual friends and.
Well, one of them.
And
oh, one person I didn't know at all.
Just one.
And, yeah.
And you wrote it.
And it was a song I had heard many years ago, and I knew I wanted that song. So I found her online, and she wrote me a beautiful email back. She went, checked out my website, made sure everything was legitimate. I'm not some kind of porn star or something like that. And
right.
She said, yes.
Wow.
And everybody loves that song so much. Her name is Deb Talon, a song called Forgiven.
Oh, The Forgiven, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, but all the songwriters. And, you know, the support that I got from them, like, amazing, you know, just amazing. I mean, those guys, I want this film to do well for them, you know, more than me. I know it sounds like, oh, you know, but I really mean that. Like, I want these people to be recognized, especially Steve, for his work. I want people to, because I believe if he gets recognized, he'll be scoring films for the rest of his life. Like he won't be doing anything else. Because, you know, any reasonable person in the film industry will watch this film and think I had a $500,000 budget to do the music.
Yeah, it's insane. And you're in several other festivals coming up, right? You made that in the submission to in New York, and there's one other, I think, that you mentioned.
Well, we were selected to New York Independent Cinema Festival, the Milan Gold Awards in Italy, the New York Movie Awards, I think they're called. Something I can't even remember, but I've submitted to. I mean, I just started submitting, so
great.
I've submitted to a number of festivals, and we're just waiting to hear. You know, it's funny. I don't even really know what to do with this film because I've never done this before. Like. I was going to do a screening. I found out I shouldn't do a screening because for some of these festivals, it has to stay private. It has to be a debut. So I also found out that there was a theater down in Asbury that wanted to show the film in a private screening. And the guy said to me, well, do you have a DCP? And I was like, well, I don't do drugs or I don't smoke weed or anything like that. He's like, what? He said, a DCP. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, it's a format of film. I didn't even know what he was talking about.
Wow.
You have to put the film into a format that any theater could play.
Okay.
You're like, right now I just have a digital file, you know?
Right.
So I have to figure out, so I know nothing, you know? So I'm learning, you know, I'm trying to learn what to do and how to figure it out. So I've submitted to a bunch of places, but it's expensive to submit. You know, most of these festivals cost anywhere between $60 and $120 just to submit your film as best feature. But if you want to get into best score, director, all that kind of stuff, it's additional money.
Okay, right.
So, you know, most people who do films have backing and,
right.
and have budgets.
Sure.
So they put aside $20,000 or $30,000 to submit just to Sundance for every festival or Tribeca. So when you submit to every, it says like best feature, best indie feature, $85, and then or all categories, $490. And I'm like, who could do that more than once or twice, you know?
Right.
But people submit to hundreds of festivals. So my budget for this film was $282. You know, like I had my cell phone and I bought an ND filter, a little clip for the phone, and I bought a cheap lavalier mic. And that was it. You know, like I just started recording. I mean, I knew I had a good phone. I was able to record 24 frames per second. Like professionally, I knew that I could professionally record video and audio. That I knew.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it was all instinct. I had never owned a camera. I didn't know how to shoot anything. I didn't know anything about framing or white balance or ISO or anything like that. I learned that from, you know, Gerald Undone and Danny Gewirtz and Brandon Lee and all these YouTube personalities.
That's amazing.
You know, Dan Unboxing and, you know, Purpose Lens and Media. Like I learned from these people how to do that, literally, you know, like I went to school and then I had to learn how to edit video, which is the hardest thing in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And so, but because of Phil Clendenin, my music mentor, I was so well versed in digital audio that I knew how to use these programs. So I was able to have a little head start into editing audio. But I chose DaVinci Resolve to edit the video. And of course, DaVinci Resolve is by far the hardest program to use, but I picked it because it's free. I mean, I wound up paying for the professional version because there was some stuff in there that I needed. But for the first 6 months, I worked in the free version. And I'm glad that I got it because it's the hardest one by far. And so now, you know, most filmmakers use Premiere Pro, Adobe program.
Yes.
And I'm sure I could learn that quickly because it's it's easier to use than DaVinci Resolve. So, yeah, you know, the thing is for me, I've learned more in the past 2 years than I've learned in my whole life combined.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Like, I know how to use a camera. You know, I know what I'm doing. Not to say that I'm anywhere near where I want to go. You know, I have so much to learn, and I certainly could not work as a cinematographer or anything like that. But I just shot a full-length film, and it's pretty good. And I'm shooting another one, and I'm doing a documentary for a friend of mine. So pretty soon I'll feel comfortable enough to take money from people to do documentaries and things like that.
It's beyond inspirational. As you said to me the other day, hey, look, I went in there first trying to get a camera, and I said, oh, now I got to get a lens? Yo. Right. I gotta get a lens now.
I didn't even know. I bought the camera and it showed up, and I was like, "How do you?" I actually called the guy who sold it to me. I bought it on eBay, and I was like, "How do I use this?" He goes, "What are you talking about?" I said, "It doesn't work." He goes, "Well, what lens are you using?" I said, "What are you talking about?" Like, I didn't even know there were interchangeable lenses. Right, I didn't know that was a thing.
Right. No,
now I own like 7 lenses.
Oh, my.
And I'm like, I'm in the lens market all the time. I've sold and bought lenses already. I'm obsessed because I've studied the reason you use lenses, like the emotional and spiritual reason that you choose a 50 millimeter as opposed to a 12 millimeter. And so I've listened to these interviews with these famous directors, and it's so interesting to me. So I'm obsessed with lenses and color science. Like, I chose to use a specific color for the film because I listened to filmmakers talk about how they use color and why. And I was like, wow, so that makes sense to me. Like, The Godfather was all about color. Mm. You know, they use certain colors for different reasons, to kind of get you to feel certain things, because when you see a certain color and then you see it again in a different circumstance, it kind of brings you back. And so it becomes reminiscent of what happened earlier in the story. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, some people only shoot in wide angle lenses because it distorts your face a little bit. And like the Coen brothers, they always have those kind of people look kind of odd.
Yes.
And they choose certain kind of lenses. And like, but Francis Ford Coppola shoots 35 millimeter mostly because he wants it to look like normal life, like just regular, you know? So it's really amazing, you know, zoom lenses. I didn't even know what a zoom lens was, or a prime lens. I'm so honored by the process, you know? So it's been such a gift to, at this stage of my life, to be learning so much, you know, to be willing to learn so much, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's part of the thing for the question you asked before. Like, if my life were different right now, I don't know if I would have the time to do all of this. Like, you know, I'm completely unattached, not ecstatic about that. You know what I mean? Like, I get pretty lonely sometimes. Like, I live such an incredibly solitary life. But, you know, my plays are 2 hours, 2.5 hours long. My filmmaking takes up all the time. Like, I am constantly studying and working. Like, who would put up with that? You know what I mean? Like, that's a difficult, so I have the time to do it. So I'm, you know, now I think I have to learn how to make my life better too, like balance.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I left the city. I want more balance in my life. I want to have a life, you know, I feel like it's not healthy to continue to work in the way I'm working for the rest of my life. It's of no value, really. you know, overall.
It's an all-consuming creative process. As you're getting ready for these, you know, big performances, and, you know, you're moving a work, you're bringing a work out into the world. It's a birthing process. So it's all encompassing right now. And that's through the way.
If you look at my calendar, I have scheduled a year in advance of what I'm rehearsing. Like if I'm doing a play, I rehearse, like I have to rehearse my lines 6 hours every day. Period. 6 hours. I must do that. And so, you know, think about that. Like we sleep
right there. Yeah.
We sleep overnight, you know, so then there's only like 12 hours left.
Yeah.
And I have to eat and I have to take a shower and go to the bathroom and I run every day. And you know, and I have to make money. I have to figure out how to live my life. But no matter what I'm doing, and I always make sure if I have to do side hustles to make money, whatever, I make sure that I choose something where I can rehearse. Mm-hmm. So I do by myself, you know, like it's, you know, adds to my solitary life, but there's no way I could do what I do without doing it that way. So, you know, I'm always trying to figure out how to do it better, but you know, I'm really, you know, I feel good. I'm really grateful with where I'm at. And I'm just trying to do better now, you know what I mean? And really looking forward to working on this next film because now I know what I'm doing. And so I want to see, you know, the hardest thing is, as you definitely know, is to keep the energy to continue to work at a certain level. You know, it takes so much energy.
Yeah, so much.
Not even physical energy, but mental energy to just keep doing, to stay self-motivated and to stay committed. It takes so much to do that, you know? That's why I have so much respect for artists like Coltrane or Kobe Bryant or you guys, you know, like, you know, we know what it takes to be at the highest level of what you do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I had a director, you know, I worked with Reggie Gaines, who was my director for Brooklyn Quartet. And Reggie is, you know, he's...
Yeah, bring on the noise, bring on the funk, right?
Right. Reggie, so he wrote that. And he's a pretty well-known guy.
Yeah.
And he's also a world-class tennis player in his age group now. Like he is perhaps the top tennis player in the world in his age group.
That's great.
And, you know, he still talks. Like I was talking to him recently and he was talking about, he went out and played one day with these guys who were older than him. Like, you know, these guys who were like 70. And I said, what was that like? He goes, I crushed them. I embarrassed them. I put them down. And I was like,
he's competitive. Yeah.
Really? And I'm like, but you know what? He's still like when he steps out on that court and he approaches his art in the same way, you know, like when he teaches workshops and stuff like that, he is very, you know, a lot of people think he's hard on them or kind of intolerant, but he's just like, he maintains that desire to be at a certain level.
Yeah,
and that's why he's still
holding it to a higher standard, you know, holding it to a higher standard. It's part of the discipline of the work. What you bring to it, you know, and I think that's what makes it so beautiful. It's a life of Kaizen, you know, never ending improvement every moment of every day. And Rock, your journey, what's most important to you now? And what does the road ahead look like for you? And what's next?
My health.
Yeah. Good.
The people who I love, that they're okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to just, you know, I don't know, like I'm the way the world is right now. I don't know what to think about all that, you know, like I could, you know, say all the things that people say, like I hope for a better world and all that kind of stuff. You know, I just want to continue to learn. I want to continue to grow. I want to have, you know, I want to make sure that I nurture the relationships that I have in my life, you know. I don't, you know, I've lost so many people, you know, I've experienced so much loss in my life. So I want to be able to manage that because, you know, as we get older, that gets, you know, and then you really start losing people faster, you know?
Yes. Yes.
So I think, you know, I think for me is to just be, to try to find some joy every day, you know, every day, no matter what, you know, because first of all, I'm so kinesthetic. I think I'm dying every day. You know what I mean? Like anything, I feel anything in my body, I think it's over.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah,
I never know if I'll work again. You know, as an artist, you never know what's going to happen. That's why I really focus on the day-to-day work. You know, like for me, it's about the work. Like it sounds so cliche, but I'm all about the work, and I'm all about the what I'm doing in this moment. I'm trying to be present and learn something new every day and do better work, you know, and contribute. I want my work to contribute, you know, like because of Brooklyn Quartet, I became close with Sean Bell's family. You know, I met all these mothers who lost their children to gun violence. Like I got to have Q&As for 5 years about racism, white privilege, gentrification, you know, sexism, and in theaters with, you know, full theaters with all kinds of people from all different places talking about white privilege. Like, I want to continue to be able to do work that contributes in some kind of way. Like, I'm not somebody who thinks I can change the world. You know, like, I think that's bullshit. But I want to, my desire, my intention is to contribute, you know, to leave some kind of legacy. Like, I don't have kids. So that's why filmmaking, I'm falling more and more in love with filmmaking, because this work will live forever. Like, I regret having not allowed anyone to record Broke Wide Open.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Like, the production that I did, that off-Broadway production was incredible. That was like a Broadway show. I had this incredible mural by a guy named Jason Cicino. You know, I had lighting design that was like, it looked like I was walking in and out of clouds. It was a beautiful off-Broadway production. And I was like, nope, this is theater, live theater. Like, you have to be here to experience it. And those who will come have seen it. That's it. You know, and I did 8 shows a week for months.
Yeah.
But I want to do better work. I want to nurture my relationships. I want to stay as healthy as I can. And I want to just keep learning, you know, and just be happy. You know, I think that's it. You know, I would love to have, I would love to deal with the challenge of being unbelievably successful and see, you know, like, I love the story of George Clooney, who brought 10 of his best friends together and gave each of them a suitcase of $1 million. Did you hear that story?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
He took 10 of his best friends away with him on a trip, a weekend trip.
Okay.
And he said, you know, you people have been incredible to me my whole life and blah, blah, blah. And I want to do something for you. And he gave them all a suitcase. And he said, now open the suitcase. And they opened it up. And they each had $1 million in cash.
Wow.
I would love to be able to fund people's projects, give people home, you know, pay people's mortgage, to pay, you know, like, there's somebody who I want to pay her student loans off, you know, like
giving. Yeah. Giving.
That's why I would love to be successful and to feel safe, you know?
Yes.
But, you know, I don't have any, you know, like, I don't have the same goals that I used to have. Like, I must get a record deal, or I must go to Broadway or whatever. I must do the greatest work. The rest of it is for the universe to decide what's going to happen. I know, you know, I've gotten to the point in my career where I know what my work is. You know, I don't doubt how good the work is.
Yeah.
That's for other people to judge anyway. You know what I mean? I want to be happy with it.
Yeah.
You know, I know that, you know, people who criticize or whatever, I'm always like, you know what? Try to do what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
You know, just try to go write a play first, then try to memorize it for 2.5 hours, then try to make it good, then put it up on its feet, and then try to have the physical ability to be out there every day doing it. Like my friend Lisa, the singer, you know, people think she could just get out and sing the way she sings every night. She's an athlete, you know, like she sings like a freak, like some kind of freak of nature. I mean, her voice is like, you know, 30 octaves. I mean, she's a complete freak of nature, the most beautifully gifted vocalist. But people don't know what she goes through to stay healthy, to stay strong, to sing. Lisa Fisher, you know, like.
Yes. Yeah.
I have so much respect for her. But, you know, she's a very dedicated, committed person and knows how to get in that zone as well, to be in a solitary place to do the work that's required. So that's all I want. You know, I want the opportunity to continue to do what I do, to live for as long as I can. And so hopefully people will look at my work at some point and go, you know, he contributed something, you know. And again, I have stories that I know that I've contributed to some people. And that makes me feel good. Those are the, that's the best part of the work, when people tell you something like, really?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, I have stories like that. So that's meaningful to me. What is your intention with your art? You know, I feel like as an artist, we have an opportunity to elevate the consciousness of people, to disrupt the day-to-day bullshit that people get stuck in, and have them, you know, kind of connect in a way, you know, like for me, that's why I love live theater so much, because I bring people into a sacred performance space together to share a story. But, you know, film is amazing because I can reach, you know, if I have a success like this film, millions of people could potentially see it. You know, if I win more festivals, it's going to get, you know, it's already been, I won a festival in Milan, Italy.
That's amazing.
So like a whole bunch of people there have seen it now, you know, so it's amazing to me. So it's an opportunity that I don't take for granted. This woman I know once said that to me, and she goes, you know, as an artist, you have a responsibility to raise the bar if you can. Like, you should at least try. Maybe you can't. That should be your intention. That's certainly my intention, is to do that. Because then to me, as an artist, that's like a life well-lived. You know, if you, like, you know, look what you do, you know. Like, how many people have been helped by active isolated stretching? And who've come into the clinic over the years, wherever it was, you know, like...
Yeah. And you feel,
you know, it changed my life.
Thank you.
And it changed a lot. You know, I know, and I brought people to you who I know it changed their lives, you know?
I think that's the Enzo moment, as they say in the Zen practice, is the artist reaching that highest point. And, you know, I think it's so beautiful, the art that disrupts, but your art unifies, though, by bringing this disruption that, you know, some people try to push under the carpet, right? And marginalize. And I think that's the beauty in it. And I know that you are extremely successful, and I know that you know it in terms of the work. And that's,
I'm always trying. Yeah. I'm always trying.
That's what's most important. And if we look back on your life, Rock, any parting gems of advice you'd like to leave for us?
Advice. I would just say, stay healthy.
Yeah.
And listen. Listen to people. Don't talk so much, you know, listen and stay open. Because as Mr. Rollins once said to me, you know, I was sitting with him in Riverside Park. He was 99 years old at the time.
Wow.
And he said, Rock, the only thing I've learned about life, the only thing I know, is that you have no idea what's going to happen 5 minutes from now, let alone tomorrow. None. Like, you, tomorrow could be the greatest day of your life. It could be the worst. You have no idea what's going to happen. Anything can happen at any time. So if I were to tell you anything, just prepare every day.
Yeah.
Do your work, because the only thing that people can't take from you is the work that you do from day to day, the life that you live every single day. That's your life. You know, that's it. That's your existence. You know, you have no, you know, tomorrow, you know, this film could take off. You know, I could be offered, you know, like, it's funny because the Red Plaid Suitcase, which was the play I was supposed to open, to me, it's like an old play now, but nobody's ever seen it because I never got to perform it.
an old play that was 2019, right? Or 2020.
Yeah. But I worked on it since 2016 or 17, I mean, to prepare to do it. So it's like, you know, unless somebody offers me crazy life-changing money, why would I do that play now? I already did, you know, the story is basically, it's based on the same thing as the film. I promised myself I would never get on stage unless I felt absolutely compelled to tell the story that I'm telling. But the thing is, you know, I think I have Rollins in the back of my head all the time because he always says, be prepared for anything that might come. You know, if you're going to be an artist, be an artist. If you're going to be a plumber, be a plumber. You know, if you're going to be a chef, be a chef, like, be the best, you know, go as far as you can go, be as high as you can be, you know, like, go to a place where, you know, only Michael Jordan lives, or John Coltrane lives, or Leontine Price, or, you know, James Baldwin, like, go to that place because you never know where somebody might put you in a space where you can share that, you know, or where you might be needed. You know, like you've worked with Olympic champions, you know, world champions. So when you get called on to do that, if you just kind of let it go for a while and then go, oh yeah, I did that 6 years ago. But I'm quite sure if somebody called you today, you could help them.
Got to be ready.
So that's the only advice I don't like to give advice. People ask me my opinion on stuff all the time. And I'm like, yeah, I ain't that guy. If somebody asks me my opinion on their play or their poetry or music or whatever, I just say it's awesome. Like, if you're working hard, because you don't know where somebody is in their process.
That's right.
There's no reason to not be encouraging. There's no reason to criticize anybody, in my opinion. Unless you're working at the highest level and the highest level is working with you, and it's because you're trying to win an NBA championship or you're trying to, you know, like steel, sharpen steel, you know, like.
Right.
That's a different kind of criticism. But I just say work on whatever is important to you, be kind, and stay healthy, you know, and find some joy, because ain't nothing promised, you know, like you never know. You know, we don't know what's going to happen from day to day. My best friend died when he was 42 years old, you know. I know a lot of, you know, I have a friend whose husband was a triathlete. 41 years old. He got up one morning, he went to work, he got into his office, and his heart exploded. He had never smoked, drank, drugs, nothing. He was a triathlete.
Right.
41 years old, his heart just exploded. So he had some pre-existing condition from childhood, but he left behind a beautiful family, a beautiful legacy. You know, now they have all these foundations in his name, all this stuff.
Wow.
So I think about him all the time, you know, because obviously his kids and his wife were forever changed and imprinted, you know, with this event. But on the other hand, that's the thing. Life is so brutal. You know, things like that sometimes catapult you to do things that you never in your wildest dreams thought that you would do or could do. And you might live in pain for the rest of your life. But you might get to a point where you help so many other people because of that pain, because of that adversity. So life could be fucked up, you know, it's brutal. But it's, you know, the brutal parts are beautiful too, because we can, like, probably that family doesn't look at it that as beautiful. But I'm so inspired by that, you know, like, and I know that a lot of things in their lives would not be if the father survived. You know, so, and I'm sure we can all think of many stories like that. You know, I mean, there are a lot of stories like that, you know. So the most beautiful time of my relationship, I had no relationship with my father until he got sick and died. But I took care of him for the last 3 months of his life. And we repaired everything between us. And I walked him to his death. I took care of him every day until he died. And I'm telling you, we had no relationship.
Wow.
Like, you know, we had sports in common, but I was such old to him. And he, you know, we didn't mix very well. You know what I mean? I was a difficult kid. You know, I was really hard. And, you know, I called him out all the time. I felt like he was racist. And I told him every chance I got when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
All the way to adulthood. Oh, yeah. But he never shut me down ever. He was a good man. You know, he was open to me. He let me be who I was. But I was a to him, you know. But when he got sick, I was the one who took care of him. And I stopped doing everything, and we repaired everything. And so it taught me the worst part of his life was probably the most beautiful part of his life in many ways, because we had such a great time.
Yeah.
During this time where he lost 100 pounds and every bone in his body was broken and he was in surgery, you know, he went through so much pain and so much, but we had so much fun. Yeah. So that's like, it's crazy.
Yeah. The suffering can be such a gateway to higher understanding.
Yeah. And that's something we have to learn with time.
Yeah.
you know, but, and then you die.
That's right.
So that's why I'm saying, I guess the biggest lesson for people is to be present, you know? And I try to learn that every day because, you know, I complain a lot, you know, and not too many people, but I have like two people I can complain to and they can complain to me, you know,
That's good.
But we realize it's stupid. You know what I mean? It's just get it out of your body.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Got to move it out. You got to move it out.
Because you'll die from that too.
That's right.
So like, get it out of your body, go drink some wheatgrass, go try to run. But, be grateful. Like I'm in a beautiful space. You know, the people who own this place were kind enough to rent this place to me. They could have given it to anybody.
Yeah.
You know,
it looks really
nice. Beautiful neighborhood. I needed to get out of my place. I was living in pure hell.
Yeah.
You know, even though I love that block and that neighborhood so much, that's the first place I lived, but the building I was living in was hell. It was pure, like the worst living circumstance, violence, everything, like bad. So I'm so happy here, you know, even though I'm like, where am I? I don't even know where I am, you know, but I'm so happy here. And I feel like, you know, I wanted to come a little bit farther away from the city so I could start a new part of my life.
Yeah.
See what happens. And it's not happening yet, you know, or maybe it is, but I don't know about it. Yeah. I guess it's happening because it's always happening.
The nature cure. You're getting the nature cure now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Vitamin N.
Yeah. Thank God. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm trying really hard to not take it for granted for even one day. Like I go down to the river every day and I just think, wow, I live here.
Yeah.
I mean, although, you know, I live near the river in the city too, but it's different, you know? I mean, I try to go up to Hyde Park and Rhinebeck, and I went to New Paltz today. And
yeah.
You know, every time I go to New Paltz, I'm like, wow, this is like the moon. Like it's so gorgeous.
Yeah. 300 miles of carriage roads up there and just winding around the Schwandunk Ridge. It's incredible. Yeah. Yeah.
It is not to be taken for granted. All the lakes and the river and the waterfalls and it's a gorgeous place. And, you know, and I look forward to, I don't want to feel like I have to run back to the city for my art. I want to contribute something here too. You know, I want to see if I could build something. I have a friend who lives in Woodstock. He wants to open a theater. He's a Broadway producer.
Wow. Okay.
So he's pretty much retired from doing Broadway, and he's got a place in the city, but he mainly stays in Woodstock with his wife, and he's thinking of opening a theater.
Fantastic.
So, and he would want me to open the theater, you know, with my show. So then I would have to do the show, unless I wrote a new show. But, and you know, he's probably not going to do it for a year or two. But, and, you know, I do know some people up here. You know, I have a friend from the music business who lives in Red Hook. She's an incredibly gifted musician, producer. I do know the poet laureate of Dutchess County. She's the reason I came here. She told me about this apartment.
Oh, that's great.
But I haven't seen her since I've been here. I've seen her once since I've been here, and I've been here for 4 months already. So, but you know, the pandemic kind of changed.
Right. The interactions. Yeah.
Ironically, there's only been one person who's come to my apartment since I've lived here. And it's my friend Audrey, who's my bestie. And she lives in, you know, Teaneck, New Jersey. But she made it her business to drive up here. And we spent some time together. But she's like my breakfast buddy. You know, we eat pancakes.
Oh, that's great.
At least once a month. Well, we did before the pandemic.
Yeah.
But, I look forward to seeing what's next, you know, and it's unknown. We don't know, you know. I want to, hopefully, I pray that I stay inspired. That's it, you know. That's everything, because, you know, I think when you start to get tired and you start to lose that inspiration, that's when, you know, that's when it's scary, you know.
Right.
If you don't have a lot of money, where you could just take a deep breath and go, okay.
Right.
I'll move to Boca.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
I don't see you doing that, Rock.
I'm wearing sandals and white socks.
Oh, Rock.
No, I wouldn't go to Florida anyway. That's a scary place.
No, that is not you. That is not Rock, it's such a blessing to see you today. And man, thank you for sharing your story here on Intrinsic Drive. You've been amazing to be with.
Thank you, man. My honor to be here. Honor and privilege.
One, two, three, four. Here's my story. Little baby born, cute little thing. Tiny little nose, little ears. Mother said he's gotta make it on his own. She's gotta let him go, oh no. Put him in a system, he's always gonna wonder if his mother ever missed him. We move ahead and hope that life is gonna bless the little boy, we hope so. Hey, hey. Strange how he never really feels like he's at home. He's running like a lone wolf, even though he's only 5 years old. Ooh yeah, he read a little book, now he's always gonna know that he was chosen. And she reminds him over and over.
You really should know your father's mother didn't accept you. It's different when two people have their own. You're special in your own way, you're different than the others. I swear on a stack of Bibles that I love you. Just like family, closer than my cousins, almost like my blood, this is what it is. I'm not sure who you are, I really don't know where you came from. I'll treat you like my own.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It was the end of the summer, just before we go to school. We load up in the car like one big happy family. And by the way, my parents chose a brother and sister for me. Ooh yeah, my mom's had a brother who was married to the mother of my cousins who were just a little younger than me. A 4-hour drive, you get excited to see your people. Are we there yet?
Pretty soon.
And each year we'd arrive, there was nobody home. It never felt to me like a great big deal, just an empty house with the front door open. Spent the weekend watching a lot of TV. And never one time did we sit down for a meal all together. The mother of my cousins who were just younger than me was staying late at the library, not very nice. Such a long drive, I can't pretend, oh, I can't pretend. No, somebody won't let me.
You really should know your father's mother didn't accept you. It's different when two people have their own. You're special in your own way, you're different than the others. I swear on a stack of Bibles that I love you. You're just like family, closer than my cousins, almost like my blood, this is what it is.
I'm not sure who you are, I really don't know where you came from. I'll treat you like my own, yeah.
Lately the only time I feel at home is when I'm sleeping.
Ooh yeah,
I get to see my mother and my father, but only in my dreams.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I bet you I'm confusing you. Who am I referring to? Guess I'm still that child, the five on the inside, living on the outside. Make no mistake about it, something you should know.
And she said, oh,
I repeat,
wow.
You really should know your father's mother didn't accept you. It's different when two people have their own. You're special in your own way, you're different than the others. I swear on a stack of Bibles that I love you. Just like family, closer than my cousins, almost like my blood, this is what it is. I'm not sure who you are, I really don't know where you came from. I'll treat you like my own.
Say it again.
Treat you like my own.
Yeah,
I treat you like my own.
Hi,
treat you like my own.
Oh,
I'll treat you like my own.
Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you opting in, subscribing, and reviewing us, for thumbing us up and following us on socials, liking us. We like you. Drop us a note. Tell us what stories move you. For books, videos, resources, and more information, visit us at whartonhealth.com/shopwhartonhealth. And be sure to join us for the next episode of Intrinsic Drive.